Scalars actually have quite an important role to play in various applications of gravity that are sort of current or of interest or mainstream. I mean, the most obvious application is in cosmology, where we have scalar fields seem to get introduced to sort of solve all ills. So, for example, inflation, which is a key part of the standard cosmological model, is usually assumed to be driven by a scalar field. Another example where scalar fields crop up in cosmology, though without quite the same amount of observational evidence, is in looking at late time acceleration. So those of you that go to the cosmology course will be learning just how we believe that our universe is currently accelerating. So whilst a cosmological constant is a very easy way of getting an accelerating universe, there's also a lot of alternatives, and in particular, many of those have scalar fields, either standard scalar fields that are producing dark energy, or sometimes scalar fields involved in modifying gravity. So that's just scalars in cosmology. But then, of course, scalar fields crop up usually in any extension of Einstein gravity. And in particular, string theory tends to imply that we have an awful lot of, or potentially an awful lot of scalar fields in our sort of four-dimensional effective theory. So the obvious one, let me just write some of this down. So in string gravity, we have a sort of particularly core scalar, the dilaton, but we also tend to get scalar, as well as others, but scalar moduli, which correspond to, essentially, we could also say, extra dimensions. So these are sort of linked. And in fact, even the dilaton can be regarded as a scalar modulus if you regard string theory as derived, at least from the gravity end, we can regard 10-dimensional supergravities as being derived from 11-dimensional supergravity, in which case the dilaton is just yet another scalar modulus. So the idea here is simply that if we have sort of a G, higher dimensional G, which we can split into G4 and Gn, then this internal space has some sense of size, and an overall scale would be an example of a scalar modulus in our projected down into our four-dimensional universe. So another place where they occur in string gravity is, of course, in applications of ADS CMT, so the supposed correspondence between sort of the idea of the gauge gravity duality and looking at condensed matter systems. So scalar fields crop up all over the place. So today I wanted to talk about aspects of scalar fields with gravity, and I'll start off by covering something I think you at least met in the original course, or I think it was mentioned, but I don't know how much you went into detail. And it's something I'd like to talk about more because it's actually quite quite an important technique, thinking about how to have non-canonical gravity, so ways of modifying gravity. And the absolute simplest way of modifying gravity is to change it from a purely tensor theory to what we call a scalar tensor theory. And the JBD stands for Jordan Brands Dickey. Who developed this theory of tensor gravity in, well, it was basically in the 60s, but I think Jordan was thinking about certain aspects of it, maybe late 50s, if I remember rightly. And so the idea is that in Einstein's equations, we have a relation between our curvature, the Einstein tensor, and our energy momentum, so the idea that matter curves space. And there's a coupling constant, which is Newton's constant. And by sort of definition, in a way, usually in Einstein gravity, that's taken to be a constant. So scalar tensor gravity essentially makes Newton's constant no longer constant, but somehow space-time dependent. So the original motivation for thinking about scalar tensor gravity was to try and incorporate Max principle into a geometric theory of gravity. So one of the things that Einstein felt was slightly lacking, I don't know, sort of maybe what he wished he could have overcome was the fact that in the theory of gravity that he proposed, the way in which you bolt together this idea of the geometry, so you have this nice purely geometrical side, and then you're slotting the matter in with a fixed coupling, and then kind of using already known Newtonian theories of gravity to decide what the coupling is. So how do we know what strength matter should curve geometry with? Or, in another way of thinking about it, how do we know if we have, say, a pail, this is a sort of standard analogy, if we have a pail of water, and we go into space, and we set it spinning, then what is that pail of water spinning with respect to? So there's this notion of what is inertia. If you've got a non-inertial motion, what are you accelerating with respect to? And in our universe, we have a notion of a fixed frame, which is our cosmological frame. And so I guess Max principle was this idea that somehow the matter in the universe defined our frame and defines what you mean by inertia, and therefore a sort of sense of, you know, what's going to give you a gravitational coupling. So that's the sort of philosophical background to this particular modification of gravity. And so the idea is we take the gravitational action, so this is what the sort of pure vanilla Jordan Brands Dickey action is. So you see that we've replaced Newton's constant by some scalar field multiplying the Ricci scalar, and then we've added a kinetic term. And this omega, just the way it's conventionally written, We'll see how that becomes relevant in a comparison between Jordan Brown's sticky gravity and general relativity. So we vary our action. What I want to do is to derive a set of equations of motion. So the variation with respect to phi is reasonably straightforward. So I've already done an integration by parts there on the kinetic term to get the box phi. Then when I vary with respect to the metric, I'm going to pick up the Einstein tensor, as per usual over here. I'm going to pick up the sort of normal type of terms that I pick up from a scalar field Lagrangian. So those are fairly straightforward. I'll deal with those first. Right, so that's simply taking the standard Einstein tensor and varying the d phi squared piece with respect to the metric. But then I've also got these extra terms. So remember when we looked at the variation of the Ricci scalar, we had things that were dependent. We had this extra piece. It was a total derivative, but it was dependent on the derivatives of the variation of the metric. So before, because it was a total derivative when g was a constant, we could just throw it away from a variational principle perspective. But now that we've got this scalar field, which is potentially space-time dependent, we can't. And so this is going to give us extra pieces. In our equations of motion. So that's what we get from varying the Jordan-Brown sticky action. And so our Einstein equations, or whatever, so instead of just having simply the Einstein tensor there, multiplying the delta GAB piece, I've got the Einstein tensor, I've got derivatives of the scalar field. I've got second derivatives of the scalar field. And then I've got something that looks more like an energy momentum tensor. So I've got quite a lot going on. So that's I've sort of put in the energy momentum tensor there. So that's my new Einstein equations. But then I've also got that top line where I varied with respect to phi. So I've got an extra equation. So that is r plus 2 omega. If I multiply through by phi, it's phi r plus 2 omega box phi minus so I've got a scalar equation, and that's going to equal zero, provided phi does not couple to matter. And again, in the plain pure vanilla Jordan Brand sticky theory, it doesn't. So what I mean by that is that, for example, if I had a scalar field, I've already got one, if I had another scalar field, I mean, there's absolutely no phi sitting in the Lagrangian for the scalar field. Is that a question or is it a stretch? Yeah.
So in the beginning, you mentioned the bucket of water.
Yeah.
And the question of what, with respect to what it's spinning.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if I understood you correctly. Are you saying that then in Brand-Dicke theory, the answer is spinning with respect to phi?
No, Brand-Dicke theory didn't really solve the problem. I was trying to say that this was something they were motivated by. So I'll just finish off deriving what the equation's motion are. But what you see is that phi does indeed couple to the matter content. And so the idea is that if there's matter around, phi responds to it and changes. And therefore, it's like it matter switches on a Newton's constant, which is then switching on the gravitational coupling. So it was a philosophical type of motivation, but it didn't really succeed in the way that I think, you know, the people who originally were imagining this idea to work. It didn't succeed in that way, but it was a motivation, and it's sort of, you know, in spirit you can see what it's doing. It's saying that if there's matter around, then I get a response in my gravitational coupling. So if I take the trace, so I've got two equations here. One is telling me how to modify the tensor Einstein equation, and then I've got a scalar equation. And so I can do a manipulation to try and get rid of the geometry in that by tracing over the tensor equation. Because if I trace the Einstein tensor, I get minus the Ricci tensor. So I can eliminate the geometry from these two equations, well, eliminate in an obvious way, eliminate the curvature, and end up with an equation just for phi. So if I look at what I get, I've got minus phi times the Ricci scalar. I've got a box phi term, and I get three of those overall in four dimensions. And then the last piece gives me plus, I think, yep, plus omega over phi grad phi squared equals the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So I can now add together this trace equation and the phi equation to eliminate my Ricci scalar. I mystify? Looking here, I think I've got something astray in my notes here. So. So there's something of, I can sort of sense, I'm expecting a box phi over phi there, so I'm sort of looking a little bit suspicious, but maybe it's okay. Maybe I've just... maybe it's okay. Maybe I'm just... Okie doke. So, roughly speaking, if omega is quite small, then phi has quite a strong reaction to the matter content. Whereas if omega is large, phi is not going to respond very strongly to the matter content. And so, this is telling us something about the omega parameter. That's why omega was put in. It's measuring how strong the scalar field couples to the background energy momentum content. So if I just rewrite my Einstein equation, so what I want to do is I want to have it, instead of in terms of the Einstein tensor, I want to have it in terms of the Ricci tensor. So I take the Einstein equation, I extract the Ricci tensor from the Einstein tensor, and then I'm moving it over to the right-hand side, and then I've replaced my Ricci scalar with these derivatives of the Brans-Dickey field, and then what I want to do, apart from noting cancellations, I've now got terms involving the wave operator acting on phi. And I know that that is related to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So what I've got is a relation between my RAB and TAB. So the reason I've written it in this form is that when we do tests of gravity, in particular solar system tests, what we're doing is we're looking at linearized gravity around a flat background, and we're looking at the perturbation or the gravitational field induced by some approximately spherical source. And then we look at, for example, we make measurements of geodesics in that background. So, for example, light coming from the other side of the sun, and we make a measurement of how much that geodesic has bent. So, in other words, what's the gravitational force that has acted on that particle, be it light or whatever. And the way in which the perturbation reacts to the energy momentum present is quite specific. So it responds to the matter. So we know that linearized tests our linearized tests are in very good agreement with some gravitational interaction, which is tensorial, or we would say spin 2, and massless. So in other words, we've got our box of our HAB, which is like meant to represent our variation of the metric, is going to be minus 8 pi, and then I'll call this some g. This would be in perturbations around a flat background. And so this half here is what's telling you that you have this sort of spin 2 massless mode, which then has sort of corresponds with 2 propagating degrees of freedom, et cetera, et cetera. And so you see, if you have, say, a delta, if you approximate your source by some delta function mass, so there's just a T naught naught, then you have a very specific relation between this perturbation and a sort of specific value of the perturbation with respect to that rho. So that's in when you're deriving the Einstein equations, that's how you derive the 8 pi g by comparison with Newtonian theory. And you're kind of using that this is a half. So here, you've got omega plus 1 over 3 plus 2 omega. So you can see that this coefficient tends to a half as omega tends to infinity. And so the solar system tests of gravity, which are measuring this type of response, so the response of the geometry to some background energy momentum, gives very strong constraints on this omega parameter. So that's what Brans-Dickey theory is, and it's this is sort of an indication of how you might constrain it or test it. So if omega is too small, we would see significant deviations from general relativity. So in other words, if you look at the Schwarzschild metric, there's a very specific relation between the way the time changes in the gravitational field and the way the spatial part is modified in the gravitational field. And that's coming from this factor here. So you change that factor and you're changing the response of the redshift to the response of the spatial geometry. So that's how that's measured or compared. So that's the sort of basic Brans-Dickey or scalar tensor gravity. Mm-hmm. Right, so, but in this case, if you look sort of up one board, you see the bigger that omega is, the less phi, you know, that's telling you that the less phi responds to a background T. So in this case, I'm imagining that I'm linearizing here. So I'm linearizing around a flat background. So my background, so I'm linearizing around let's say I linearize around that. Okay, so then, I mean, I haven't really talked about the, you know, the curved space wave operator or anything, but basically, if I look at this in, and then I say, well, in flat space, TAB is zero. So in flat space, phi is completely constant, it's just G or 1 over G everywhere. And R is 0 because I've got the Minkowski metric. And so this is just 0 equals 0. Now I do perturbation theory and I linearize around that background. I'm going to get delta RAB. So this is telling me about my geometry. And then I'm going to have a delta phi, comma AB over phi, then the next piece doesn't give me anything because it's second order. And then the right-hand side, phi is just a constant. And then I've got whatever my little piece of matter source is. So this is what I get. Then we look at what this delta RAB is, and we find that in flat space, it is just, actually, that should be 16, not 8, sorry. We find that that's just minus a half box of the variation of the metric plus some gauge terms. So, and then, although this bit is sitting in there, what I can do is this bit, I can also absorb. So actually, 1 over phi is just the Newton's constant. So at least to linear order, I think I can absorb that also by a gauge transformation. So basically, the bit that I want to look at or I'm focusing in on, which is a variation of the geometry, to leading order, okay, is given by that combination of the energy momentum tensor. So we'll also have a response to phi. We've also got box delta phi is going to be delta t. But that at this order, that's not feeding back into the geometry. So it's one of these, you know, order by order arguments again. So, whenever you try and modify gravity, the really tough thing is in making it agree with Einstein gravity over a sort of set of scales which are all more or less everyday scales, well, plus, you know, some semi-astronomical scales. And so this is where this plain, simple Brans-Dickey theory fails. I mean, at the time they put it forward, it was less obviously disastrous because the precision of the tests was much lower. But we now would never believe this as it stands, yeah?
I'm just curious about the action that you that they started off with. So why is it the kinetic term divided by the field itself that's not very usual?
Well, so it's funny, when I was writing this down, I thought, now why did they actually choose that? So I guess, I mean, when you actually look through at the manipulation of the equations of motion, you see how certain terms cancel out. So it's a particularly convenient way. What it's really saying something about is the way the scalar is coupling to the Ricci tensor. So if you wrote that as a canonical kinetic term, sort of a half, you know, grad psi squared or something, then your canonical field then would be, I guess, the square root of phi. So you would have a psi squared in front of r. So for some reason, I guess, they wanted to have phi r because they wanted to have their scalar field being, you know, the sort of the inverse Newton constant. So it's not, I mean, this is, I'm just presenting their plain vanilla, and I'm going to sort of remark now on variations, but I mean, I'm sure there is a reason, but it's, you know, it's not, I mean, it's certainly a particularly, it leads to quite a clean way of decomposing the way the scalar field couples to matter and the way the sort of gravitational perturbation couples to matter. So it's a nice way of tracking through what's going on. So they wanted, I guess, to answer this or to address this Mach type of question. So they wanted to have something where, you know, their scalar field is looking like the Newton's constant and it is coupling to the trace of the energy momentum. but I suppose they also wanted to have something where you would get a, you know, nice kind of pseudo-Einstein equation with those modifications. So my guess is it's sort of to do with that. It's to do with addressing the questions that they were interested in. So the other way of getting, or so this is very specific, as you pointed out, it's quite a specific sort of coupling of the scalar field to the Ricci scalar. So it's just a sort of power law coupling. But we also, if we get so hang on, before I say that. So people, you can extend so ways of extending it are to add a potential to exactly change that change. Either you could regard it as changing the kinetic term or changing the way that phi couples to r. But basically, I'll just finish the sentence. But basically, the idea of Jordan, we use Jordan Brans-Dickey theory not as a sort of bona fide proposal for modified gravity, but simply as a way of, it's the sort of basic scalar tensor gravity. So it's something where, you know, not too much is going on. And in particular, you see how the effect of having a coupling of a scalar to the Ricci scalar, so a non-minimal coupling of your scalar field to gravity, is giving you modifications to the Einstein equations. So.
Yeah, so I mean, to have the same coupling with, you know, I guess they didn't want to introduce a new parameter, like to absorb the dimensional, like, I mean, because you were saying if you use the standard kinetic term without dividing by the field, then your coupling would change. But I'm just saying that if they introduce a parameter with the dimension that solves that problem, then you still have the same coupling, but you get a new parameter. But is that what they didn't want?
To be honest, I don't know what they did or didn't want, you know. But I mean, I'm not taking this action all that seriously anyway. So I'm not sort of digging too deeply into, you know, into the sort of how the actual details of kinetic versus, you know, coupling to Ricci. What I wanted to use it for was as, you know, as an illustration of modifying gravity, and as an illustration of scalar tensor gravity, because scalar tensor gravity actually crops up all over the place. So in terms of, as an example, I mentioned dimensional reduction. So, so scalar tensor gravity means something far more general than Jordan Brand's Dickey. So we'll be seeing this explicitly when we look at Kaluza-Klein theory, but I just give a heuristic motivation of why you see these extra scalars. When you're reducing in dimensional reduction, you're sort of taking some higher dimensional space, say a d-dimensional space, and you're saying that you can represent it as a sort of product of something which is our four-dimensional universe, for example, times some sort of extra piece, a d minus four-dimensional small manifold. And we can, when we do this decomposition, we can give a scalar degree of freedom. I mean, we can give, there's also a lot more going on, but we can give a degree of freedom to the size of the internal manifold. And so this integral, at a very simplistic level, we could represent it as perhaps some fixed d minus four-dimensional integral times some scalar field. So this would be some that sort of warped compactification type of idea, but in this case where phi would depend on our space-time dimensions. So we'll see that in more detail when we do Kaluza-Klein theory, but this is just meant to give a heuristic idea. And so when we split our volume up into external internal pieces and integrate out over the internal pieces, we pick up some scalar modulus. And that is, that is analogous to the Brands-Dickey field. It's not going to be exactly the Brands-Dickey field because in general the kinetic terms are going to be different. But at least notionally you can see that it's something that's a scalar multiplying r root g. And so this sort of gives us the idea that Newton's constant is really a derived quantity. And could vary. So that's that's the sort of idea behind scalar tensor gravity. And I think it's only fair to remark that scalar tensor gravity, dealing with scalar tensor gravity, is actually, you know, it sounds like this this sort of good idea, but its real challenge is to make it compatible with cosmology. So within the context of solar system gravity, you could imagine cooking up some sort of extension of the Einstein action, which you can make work over those sort of scales. But where you really start being challenged when you look at extensions in theories of gravity is when you try and think about the history of the universe. So in cosmology, we've got a whole sort of 13 billion years of expansion history of the universe and a whole range of different energy densities. And so if we modify gravity, we have to make sure that we don't sort of, even if we can keep the solar system in good shape, that's not much good if we lose our universe in the process, right? So the real challenge for scalar tensor theories is when you hit cosmology, making them consistent with cosmology. And so in another feature that I wanted to highlight about scalar tensor theories is what I'll call choice of frame. So this is something that comes up, and I think it's quite quite an important thing to say a few words on. So what do I mean by that? What I've done when I presented the Jordan-Brown-Sticky action and derived the equations of motion is I varied with respect to the metric G, which the Ricci scalar R is the Ricci curvature of. So I've got a particular background metric, and I noted that in this middle board, I said that my scalar field did not couple to matter. So I have a unique choice of frame, and this is called the Jordan frame. So in the Jordan frame, phi does not couple to matter, but phi does couple to curvature. So our metric is a natural metric for describing matter, but perhaps not so obviously natural when we look at the gravitational part of the action. So we then define an Einstein frame by saying that the gravitational action looks normal. So that's what we mean by our different frames. So how do we get between frames? So our Jordan frame has root g r phi. And our Einstein frame, make sure I do this consistent with what I'm about to, has root g r with no phi in it at all. So how might we get between these two frames? Well, we've obviously got to change what we mean by distances, because over here we've got, typically if you think about curvature, curvature is telling us about a scale of curvature, so a length which represents our radius of curvature, and it looks like 1 over L squared. So that's telling us about a length scale of curvature. And root G is telling us about a volume factor. So that's looking like, if we have a little box, each of side length L, that's looking like L to the fourth. So overall, we've got something that's looking like some particular choice of units squared, and we multiply by phi. And over here, we want to say that it's sort of equivalent to a root GR. So we're changing how we're measuring distances between these two frames. So this is achieved by doing a conformal transformation. And so what we do here is we write our metric in one frame is related to the metric in the other frame by an overall scale factor. So this is what a conformal transformation is in general relativity. So we're changing the way we measure distance. It doesn't change angles, because angles are sort of a ratio of a dot product to the magnitude, if you like. But it does change the overall distance scale. So I'm just going to write down what happens. So this gives us a relation between the Christoffel symbols. This one's probably fairly easy to see. But then the expression for the Riemann tensor is quite long. I'll just go to the Ricci tensor. And in any case, Anna might want to set that as homework or something. Right, what's important about this is less the detail as the shape of what you've got. So you see that in making a transformation between one frame and the other, as advertised, we get a scale, a rescaling of our Ricci tensor, because we're changing the way we're defining lengths, so we're changing the way the value of our radius of curvature, but then we also pick up derivatives of the scale factor, the conformal factor. And you see that, I mean, they're not identical, but you can see that these look similar to some of the expressions that were cropping up on the other side of the other boards, which were the extra terms coming from the Jordan-Brand sticky field. And so So for our example of the Jordan-Brand sticky case in four dimensions, I'm going to choose G hat is G on phi. So that's going to give me root G hat R hat. Well, root G hat is going to be root G over root phi to the fourth. Because for every dimension, I pick up a 1 on phi. So I get root g over phi squared. And then I've got that r hat is omega to the minus 2r. Omega squared's 1 on phi. And so I've got phi r. And so I thought I'd put those the wrong way around, my hatted frames. And so that tells me that root g hat r hat phi is equal to root g r plus, sorry, there's extra pieces, of course. And so I can get the Brand-Sticky action in the form of the Einstein action. But I've also had to pay a price. Sorry, that half, I guess, should be here. But if I look at my Lagrangian and ask what's happened there, what I see is that I first of all have this scalar field coming in my kinetic coupling, and I've also changed my potential. So under a conformal transformation, my masses change, and also how my my kinetic terms change. So I get a change in the way my my other fields respond to space and time. I'll put that change in wave equation. So, although I've made gravity look simple, I've actually done an awful lot to my matter sector. So when you think about it, I think sometimes people do changes of frames a little bit too readily, or rather in too cavalier a manner, because the way you measure space and time, or the way we measure space and time, is actually quite intrinsically connected with the way our matter is responding to the geometry. So in terms of the way we measure time, well, we measure time with atomic clocks. So, you know, what's determining the way that those atoms vibrate? Well, actually, it's to do with the Schrödinger equation, which is going to sort of have some of these components in. It's going to depend on the way in which we measure, we sort of define our GTT or our GRR. So our way of sort of measuring space and time change, and also the masses of particles change. That's also going to change frequencies of oscillators. And so that means that changing a frame is not just something you do for the convenience of your gravitational action. There are other implications. So it's possibly a useful thing to do calculationally, but it's just to sort of highlight that it comes at a price. So I'll stop there, and tomorrow I want to sort of continue, I guess, setting up, looking at more, I guess, what happens with things like black holes when we've got additional matter fields, and thinking about the sort of effect of scalar fields. Okay.